Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. WITF's election 2020 coverage on Smart Talk continues today with incumbent candidates for two of the most high-profile races in the region and in Pennsylvania. In our first segment, incumbent Republican Congressman Lloyd Smucker, who is running for re-election to the U.S. House of Representatives in the 11th Congressional District, is with us. The 11th District includes all of Lancaster County and the southern half of York County. Democrat Sarah Hammond is also on the ballot. She appeared on Smart Talk earlier this week. That interview can be heard at WITF.org/elections. Congressman Smucker, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So why are you running for re-election?
I want to ensure that every American family has the opportunity to achieve their own American dream. Everyone deserves that opportunity, and here in our district in Pennsylvania 11, we do that through hard work and individual responsibility. I've lived it. I was born Amish up in this community. I was number 10 of 12 kids. I was the first in my family to go to high school, paid my way through, went to Lancaster Mennonite private school, came with tuition. I did that by hanging drywall at night, then bought right out of high school a small business from my older brother, that drywall company, and operated that for 25 years, grew it into a regional leader in commercial construction, the type of construction we were doing with several hundred employees, creating great family-sustaining jobs of building a team. It's what we call the American dream, the idea that here in this great country in which we live, if you work hard, play by the rules, make some good decisions along the way, it doesn't matter where you started. You can start with little or nothing, and you can achieve your own American dream. So that's what I'm fighting for, and I believe that you do that through limited government, through creating, putting more money in people's pockets, through reducing the regulation, reducing the intrusion of federal government. We saw that work. I was very proud to be there during this administration. I ran on that platform that I just described, tax reform, putting more money in people's pockets and regulatory relief. And it created more opportunity than we'd seen in a long, long time, the greatest economy that we'd seen in a long time.
What you just described is a classic Republican, traditional Republican platform. What do you see as your biggest accomplishments in office, and especially for your district?
Yeah, well, I think that the idea that we were able to create more jobs than had been available in a long, long time. The unemployment rate was the lowest ever, and it extended to all segments of society. So lowest unemployment rate for African Americans, for Latinos, for women, and on and on. Just saw a report recently that prior to COVID, the poverty rate in the United States had been the lowest ever. So that's affecting people's lives. So I was really proud to be there and support that. In terms of legislation that I introduced, I was proud to have legislation passed that made Lancaster and York counties a national heritage area, designated as that, which will create more economic opportunities. It sort of puts us on the map in terms of the natural beauty we have here and the history that we have here, and will create, continue to increase our reputation as a place to visit, and we'll see economic benefit as a result of that. So it was the only Heritage Act that was added over the last few years, and I was very proud to be able to get that done.
What would be your priorities if you are reelected, Congressman?
Well, several things. We really do need to restore our American way of life. You do that by defeating this environment, this pandemic, I should say, ensuring that we have safe streets. But I also think as we rebuild this economy, jobs are going to look different. Many people have lost their jobs, maybe going back to a different job. And so I think we need to continue to focus on workforce development and training. This is one of the things that I've focused on over the past 4 years, ensuring that individuals looking to change jobs or enter the workforce for the first time have the skills needed to fill the jobs that are available. So I've been a proponent of apprenticeship programs, career and technical education. I've introduced several bills along these lines. I serve on the Educational Labor Committee, so that's one of my focuses. Secondly, we need to continue to support small businesses across the community. The CARES Act included the PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program, which saved over 100,000 jobs just in our district and saved dozens, hundreds of small businesses to ensure that, you know, people have poured their lives into these businesses, and the pandemic was threatening, put them in a situation of potentially losing everything they had built for a long period of time. So I was very happy to see that we were able to provide that kind of assistance. We need to continue to ensure that we provide that that assistance. And then I am concerned about the impact on the budget, and I fully supported what we've done. It was unprecedented times, but, you know, we're adding to the debt. This is another area I've focused on. I was on the Budget Committee for the first 2 years in Congress, and I've worked in a bipartisan manner to introduce ways that we can help to control the deficit, rein in and control government spending, and also that includes addressing the government shutdowns that we've seen. So, again, I've introduced several bills that would address some areas here. We know that if we aren't able to, at some point, impose some fiscal discipline and fiscal responsibility, long term, it's going to have a real impact on the economy. So that's a priority of mine as well.
So when you talk about that assistance, agree that more is needed. What kind of assistance? Right now, it seems like it's going back and forth, negotiations between the White House and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, Democratic leaders. What kind of assistance do you support going forward?
Sure. And it's been disappointing that we haven't been able to provide this sooner. We should have come back weeks ago and extend some provisions of the CARES Act that have been most helpful. And I already mentioned the Paycheck Protection Program. We have businesses, and I've spoken to businesses all across the district throughout this pandemic and have seen the impact. But it impacts businesses differently. Some businesses are booming, but others who continue to be forced to restrict their activities, for instance, restaurants are only at 25% or 50% capacity now. They can't survive long with those restrictions in place. Tourism, hospitality, live venues, all are important in our region, and some of them have no revenue yet. So we do have to come back and help them. So that is a top priority for myself. And despite jobs coming back and millions getting back to the workforce, there's still a lot that are not able to find a job or haven't been asked to return to their job. And so I support ensuring that we continue to provide assistance to those who are unemployed. Now, I think the $600 that was included initially provided the wrong incentives, if you will. So I think we need to limit the assistance to what an individual could be making while they're working on the job, but I think it's important we continue to do that. And then we also need to ensure, it's been, a great effort to develop the therapeutics and the vaccines to ensure that we continue to have the funding available to do that.
Let me ask this first. Do you have a number in mind what you would like to see? That seems to be there are several disagreements. One is the number, the amount of money that in assistance that would be provided, and the other is where some of that money would go. I noticed you didn't mention state and local governments. That's something that Democrats say that some money should go for assistance as well. Do you have a number in mind, and should state and local governments be getting more money from the federal government?
Well, I'm open, and we've thrown around a lot of different numbers, and I don't know exactly what the right number is. I'm a part of a group called the Problem Solvers, which is 25 Democrats, 25 Republicans, and we have put forward a framework that I think is about $1.5 trillion that could actually increase based on whether how soon a vaccine is developed and how soon the economy is fully reopened. But, you know, I'm open to different numbers. I don't know exactly what that will look like. But the thing that has been most disappointing to me is that we have not, and I attribute this to Speaker Pelosi, who I believe should be taking pieces that we all agree on in the House and the Senate and the administration and begin to move those. Like, I don't understand holding out for all of the things that we don't agree on. But rather, let's do PPP. Let's help the unemployment. Let's do some of the things that we there's no disagreement on these. And the Problem Solvers Group has a framework with some numbers there, but also with provisions that we think everybody could agree to. And you know what we've said is this is too important not to continue talking. The points along the way when we saw negotiations have broken down, we advance our ideas as a way to hopefully bring negotiators back to the table. So hopefully we get this done soon. And then in regards to state and local, one of the things that I pushed for from the very beginning is that I believed, unlike what we had in the CARES Act, that we should provide maximum flexibility to the states and the counties in regard to how they use those dollars, including for making up loss of revenue. That, I think, would allow those dollars to go a lot further. What I don't think should be doing is requiring at the federal level, restricting it so much that they have to start new programs that then they later can't fund, which was part of, you know, that partially happened. We saw something along that line in the 2008 stimulus. So I believe those dollars will go further if we lift all restrictions, let them make their own decisions about how best to use the money. But I'd be open to additional assistance. I mean, I agree with those who don't think we should use this as a time to bail out fundamental structural problems that existed prior to COVID. But, you know, I'm open to additional assistance, particularly to some of the counties who, you know, in Pennsylvania, for instance, only 7 counties with a population of over 500,000 received their dollars initially directly. So, for instance, Lancaster County received about $95 million, but York County received a much less as a portion or as a, you know, prorated based on their population figures. And I think we should make that them whole. Every county should receive dollars in a similar formula. So
what you've just described seems to go a different, maybe it's a nuance, but different than what the White House is saying. That President Trump has said he doesn't want to bail out the cities that were financially, to use his words, financially irresponsible to begin with. So I just want to clarify.
Yes. So, no, I think I did address that, and that is I don't think that this should be the time when we go in and try to address fundamental structural problems based on bad decisions made by cities and states. You know, there should be a formula based on population or something of that sort. And so, no, I agree with the president in that regard. This is not the time to try to address those. These were decisions that they made that they should be solving on their own. But I think that's a different question on whether there should be additional assistance to states across the board.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WYTF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're speaking with 11th District Congressional candidate Lloyd Smucker. He's Republican incumbent in that district. The district includes all of Lancaster County and part of the southern part of York County. Congressman, you mentioned that you're part of the Problem Solvers Caucus in Congress. This is a group made up of 26 Republicans, 26 Democrats. But you vote with President Trump 95% of the time. How can you be bipartisan and part of that group that sounds bipartisan or, you know, where there's some compromise involved while voting with the president that often?
Well, so number one, I think Congress should be a deliberative body, and we will not agree on every issue. And the intent of this group is to say we recognize that members of Congress have different viewpoints, different experiences, come from different districts with very different views. But we really should be talking with one another. We should be treating one another with civility and respect and looking for areas that we can agree to help all of the American people and help our constituents. So that's why I'm very proud to be part of that group. Now, I am probably one of the most conservative members of that group, and I vote with the president because the agenda that I ran on, the agenda that I support, is the same as the president's. And I think the results speak for themselves. And this is a president who understands that it is important we fight first for American workers, American jobs, American businesses, and has been incredible in terms of the promises that he's made that he has kept. I think that, again, the results speak for themselves with the impact it's had on people's lives, numbers that we hadn't seen in a long, long time prior to COVID.
But what don't you agree with the president on?
I think if you look at my voting record, it is generally with the president, but one of the areas where I've disagreed on at times is, and by the way, this is true with some of the things that Republicans have advanced in Congress as well, is I get very, very frustrated with the way we handle our finances. We do continuing resolutions that sometimes only fund the government for a period of days or months. It has been a long time since we have literally passed a 12-month budget in a fiscal responsible manner. So, I ran a business, as I said, for 25 years. I just can't imagine running a business or even a family, a household, in the way that we run the federal government. The idea that not only don't we balance the budget, but we don't even pass a 12-month budget. And so, I've voted against some of the bills that the president has supported and our leadership has supported, what we call omnibuses or continuing resolutions, because I just think it's a terrible way handle the taxpayer dollars. And so those are some of the areas where I think we really need some improvement.
Congressman, let's face it, Donald Trump is not a traditional president. I mean, he's probably the most unique right. individual we have ever had as president of the United States. And there are a lot of people that don't care for the president's personality. You've heard conservatives say that we support his policies, but we don't like the way he attacks, that he belittles people. So, and I've heard some of your constituents, I've read letters to the editor in the newspaper that said, how can Congressman Smucker support President Trump with his behavior and the way that he tweets and attacks people and criticizes people?
Sure. Well, I wasn't raised to talk the way that the president sometimes does or tweets the way that he does. It's not the way that I conduct myself, but I can tell you the president was elected by a large majority in my district, and I think that majority will be even higher in this upcoming election. And I think the reason for that is that the people have been fed up with the governmental process and have been fed up with that a typical political leader that you described, and they wanted someone who was a disruptor, someone who was fighting for them in Washington, and someone who was unafraid to just use straight talk. And again, I don't talk that way, the way he talks sometimes. It wasn't brought up in that way, but people voted him because of that, because they wanted someone who wasn't beholden to anyone, who was willing to fight for America, and they got what they voted for, someone who like shook things up and made promises and kept those promises in a way that we haven't. It's not typical, and so, you know, yes, it's not perfect. But I'm very proud to serve with him, and I've gotten the opportunity to meet with him, to travel with him, what I can tell you is this is someone who really cares about America, and he's willing to fight for the people of America, and I think that's why people love him.
You know, his opponents would say that he cares more about himself.
I can tell you just in the time I've had the opportunity to get to know him, this is someone, I told you, repeat what I said before, he's not a perfect person, but someone who cares deeply about America and about the people about the American people.
I want to get back to COVID for just a moment. The president has said this, and he said again last night during the debate, that we've turned the corner on the coronavirus. And this is even though there are 70,000 new cases a day, numbers are going up. Do you agree with the president on that?
I do. We're certainly not out of the water yet. But I do think we are turning the corner. There's certainly light at the end of the tunnel. And here's why. I was just talking to one of the major hospital systems in Pennsylvania recently. They have reduced the number of deaths from people who are hospitalized by two-thirds. And I think the president last night used the number 85% reduction in the fatality rate. And that is true. And that's because doctors and healthcare providers are understanding the virus more and are learning how to treat it. And so, you know, we're seeing much better treatment. There's no silver bullet here where there's one particular drug or therapy that works, but there are a lot of things in combination that doctors are using that have very much reduced the fatality rate. Part of the increase, and I think we're seeing a spike up as, you know, people are indoors more, but part of the increase is also that there's more testing available, but obviously every death is a tragedy. We don't want any deaths, but, you know, watch the fatality rate, and I think we're going to continue to see that drop. And for you know, anyone under 50, it's about at the rate of the normal flu right now. So what we've learned about the virus is that, you know, we know who it attacks. Know that we can open the economy, we can open schools, and we can continue to use common sense, wear masks, socially distance, and protect those who are most vulnerable. But I think the real point here is when I think history looks back at this, and when they see how quickly a vaccine has been developed, and this is record time, it normally takes anywhere from 6 to 10 years, and this is going to be done in months. And at the same time, the treatments and therapeutics will continue to improve as well. I mean, it really will be seen, I believe, as an outstanding response to the virus. I'm not saying everything was perfect along the way. We're going to need to step back when we're through all of this. And, you know, first of all, look at how well we were prepared, which wasn't all that good. You know, the national stockpile had been left to dwindle, and things were out of date. And when we knew that at some point there would be a virus, the experts have been saying that for a long, long time. So we need to both ensure that we're prepared for this again, and then we can learn a lot about how we've responded and ensure that we've learned from that for a future virus.
I want to move on to a couple of other issues in the few minutes that we have left. You voted against the individual mandate in Obamacare that everyone must have insurance. Do you support repealing Obamacare?
I do. I think, you know, what I support is ensuring that everyone has access to health care at a price that they can afford, and that they have options available, and they have access to insurance at a price that they can afford. And Obamacare helped some individuals. There were some individuals who were not able to buy health insurance prior to Obamacare. They're receiving the subsidies that helps them pay for that now. On the other hand, Obamacare dramatically increased the premiums and deductibles for those on the plan who are not subsidized. And there's a lot of horror stories out there about how that's impacted families across the district. And so I believe we can continue to improve the healthcare system. And as a former business owner, I think the way you do that is to allow people to make their own choices. That's why I voted for eliminating the mandate, ensuring that we protect people with pre-existing conditions and implement policies such as high-risk pools that can lower the cost, but we should be allowing providers to compete with one another and insurance companies to compete with one another, and then be transparent about pricing structures so that consumers can make their own decisions and make their own choices. Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that, I wish we had so much more time because there's so many more issues I'd like to discuss. Climate change. Overwhelming majority of scientists say the world's climate is changing. Much of it is due to human use of fossil fuels. First of all, do you agree with the scientists? What can be done to slow down the rise in temperatures?
Well, I think the president had this right last night in saying that the United States is the world leader in reducing emissions. And, you know, we also are the world leader in ensuring that we have clean water, clean air. And I think we'll continue to be. And we should implement policies that incentivize that while still ensuring that we can grow the economy. And I think the two can be done together. And there's a lot of creative ideas out there about how we can reduce emissions or reduce the carbon I think that will best be implemented by allowing innovation through a strong economy. And we're going to continue to be the world leader in it. And I think the president made the right choice in removing ourselves from the Paris Accord, because the way the restrictions were applied were very unfair to the United States, would have dramatically dramatic impact on our economy, and not holding other countries like China and Russia accountable.
But do you agree with the scientists that say that climate change is man-made?
I mean, I think it is important that we continue to reduce emissions, and that we ensure that our environment and our world is clean and there for future generations.
You don't have a yes or no for me.
I think that, as I said, we are the world leader in ensuring that our environment is clean, and we're going to continue to do that.
We're almost out of time, Congressman. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Always like to have our candidates leave a message with voters. What would yours be?
Well, you know, it is an honor and a privilege to serve the 11th District. I think it's the best district across the country. It's the place where I was born, grew up, raised a family, and it's an honor to be the voice of the people of this district in Washington, D.C. To do this job effectively, you have to constantly communicate with people across the district, and we do that in so many different ways. So I'd just like to thank everyone for the opportunity to serve you, but also appreciate all the input and all the conversations that we've had to ensure that we move our communities in this country in the right direction.
Congressman Lloyd Smucker, he's running for re-election as Republican incumbent in the 11th Congressional District, all of Lancaster County, southern part of York County. Congressman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein & Lear.
Continuing with WITF's election 2020 coverage on Smart Talk, we're joined by incumbent Democratic Attorney General Josh Shapiro. The Attorney General serves as the Chief Law Enforcement Officer of Pennsylvania and represents the state and its agencies in any action brought by or against them. Additionally, the Attorney General is responsible for collecting all debts, taxes, and accounts due to the state. Republican Heather Heidelbaugh, Libertarian Daniel Wassmer, and Green Party candidate Richard Weiss are also on the ticket. Interviews with Hammond and Heidelbaugh can be heard at WITF.org/elections. Wassmer and Weiss did not respond to invitations. Attorney General Josh Shapiro, welcome to the program.
Hey, Scott, good to be back with you. Hope all is well.
Going very well, for considering the situation that we're in.
Exactly. If you're healthy and safe, that's a good thing.
That's the big thing. So why are you running again?
Look, because I want to continue our work to take on the big fights for the people of Pennsylvania. We have demonstrated time and time again that, you know, with my record, Pennsylvanians know what it's like to have an attorney general on their side. And I want to keep being the people's lawyer, to be aggressive in holding powerful institutions accountable, tackling big issues like the opioid crisis, making sure that we are in a position to, you know, help those who are desperately in need, particularly during these challenging times. I've got a proven track record of taking on these big fights for the people of Pennsylvania, and I want to keep doing that work for everyone.
When you say being on the people's side, what does that mean? I mean, does that mean there were attorneys general who weren't on the people's side?
Look, I'm not going to look backwards. I'm going to look forward. I think you have a clear contrast in this race. For me, you have someone who's willing to take on the big fights to help people. On the other side, you have someone who, you know, has spent a career defending the special interest. Let me give you some concrete examples of what I mean by that. You know, 2.3 million Pennsylvanians were about to lose their health insurance, primarily in Western Pennsylvania, because Highmark and UPMC, two major health insurance companies, were battling. I think three governors and five or six attorneys general tried to work something out with them. We ultimately had the courage to take on that big fight, and today 2.3 million Pennsylvanians can still see their doctors. When survivors who were living in the shadows for decades couldn't get someone to be their advocate against the most powerful institution on the planet, the Roman Catholic Church, who was systematically and systemically abusing thousands of children across Pennsylvania. We had the courage to take on that powerful institution on behalf of the people of Pennsylvania. When kids couldn't go outside to play and parents were worried about giving their kids the water that was coming out of the tap, we had the courage to take on the fracking companies who were poisoning some of these communities in Pennsylvania and held them criminally liable. That's just three examples out of dozens where we have stepped up time and time again to be on the side of the people of Pennsylvania. Look, folks want an attorney general who's going to be their lawyer. The powerful have plenty of lawyers and plenty of lobbyists. But everyday Pennsylvanians, they don't always have lawyers. They don't always have advocates. I'm their lawyer, I'm their advocate, and I'm their attorney general.
So I want to talk about one of the criticisms from your Republican opponent, that for you, this is a stepping stone for a run for governor. Your response to that?
I just think it's silly. I wake up every single day focused on working for the people of Pennsylvania. I think there's way too much to do right now. Way too many things on the minds of people, way too many challenges that we face as a commonwealth to be speculating about politics. And here's the thing, I mean, about my record and about some of these criticisms that have come about, you know, about politics. I ran to be a different kind of attorney general. I said I was going to use the powers of this office, as I said before, to work for people, not the powerful institutions. I was elected by the people of Pennsylvania to be their lawyer. And, you know, to minimize the work that this office can do to protect people's rights and to try and trivialize it and make it seem political, well, that's just downright cynical. And furthermore, I think it shows a lack of understanding of what the people of Pennsylvania need from their leaders. People want someone to fight for them, not to stand down, not to play games. And that's what I do. I fight for them.
Well, and I'm not going to, speak for your opponent, but the point would that, and this comes up with a lot of different races, the point that she would make is that if voters are going in, well, I was about to say into a booth, but I don't know how often that happens
some
anymore.
Some will.
But that if they are going to vote for someone running for, as the top law enforcement officer in the state, they want to know that that person is going to stick around for more than just 2 years. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Scott. No, please go ahead.
No, I was finished. Go ahead.
But people know I'm on their side, and they know I'm working my tail off for them. They know I've helped secure their health insurance and taken on powerful institutions. They know that right now I'm battling to protect their right to vote every single day in court when it's being attacked by others. So I'm going to keep doing this work for the people of Pennsylvania. It's an honor to do this work. And political speculation doesn't help families who are struggling in Pennsylvania. What does help them is to fight your tail off and work your tail off for them. And that's what I do every day.
The grand jury report that you mentioned with the Catholic Church and sexual abuse, you were lauded for that, not just across the country. I mean, it was the first across the country, but even internationally. But your opponent says that you did not give the priest and the other people named as perpetrators due process, that you knew they couldn't be charged, but you named them anyway. Now, I mean, most people, if you probably ask them, said, yeah, I'm glad that Josh Shapiro did that. But as a matter of law, did they get due process?
Of course they did. And it represents just either a total fabrication or complete misunderstanding of the law by my opponent. So let me break this down for you. I appreciate, Scott, what you said about, the average person saying, I'm glad he did that anyway. And I get that emotional response. But I don't get to do things and issue reports just based on emotion. We follow the law. The law here in Pennsylvania specifically affords the Attorney General the opportunity and some DAs the opportunity to issue grand jury reports, as we did in this case. But understand, I can't just issue a grand jury report because I want to. It has to be approved by grand jurors who are made up of everyday Pennsylvanians. In the case of the grand jury report into clergy sexual abuse, it was 23 women and men from Pennsylvania. After it's approved by those grand jurors, it then needs to be approved by the grand jury judge. And that is to ensure that there is due process. If someone is named in a grand jury report, they are afforded the opportunity to review the report and affix to the report any writings that they want to defend their position or defend, whatever the allegation is. In the case of the clergy abuse report, it was not only approved by the grand jurors, not only approved by the grand jury judge, but because the Catholic Church and their supporters fought us so hard over so long in court, it actually made its way all the way up to the state Supreme Court, who ultimately had to certify that the due process standards as required under Pennsylvania law were met. Those named were afforded the opportunity to affix whatever writings to the report that they wanted. And only after a determination was made on due process were we permitted to release that report. So to suggest that somehow, this should have remained a secret, or that the survivors should have never been heard, or that we should have never had this reckoning in our Commonwealth, in our country, it's outrageous. And it frankly speaks to the attitude that apparently my opponent has, that we need to be on the side of the powerful special interests as opposed to the people, who in this case were desperate for closure, desperate for truth. And as a result of that truth we were able to bring about, not only have these survivors been able to heal, but we've changed the laws in this Commonwealth to protect children going forward. 22 other state attorneys general launched investigations modeled after ours. Other states changed their laws, modeled after the recommendations that came from the grand jurors. And the Pope himself acknowledged the truth of what occurred here in Pennsylvania and has convened global conversations about the sexual abuse of children within the Roman Catholic Church. None of that happens without this grand jury report, a report that, again, had the proper due process required under law. I'm very proud of the work that my office did, that the grand jurors did, but most importantly, I'm incredibly proud of the survivors who had the courage to finally share their truth. And as a result of their courage, real healing has occurred in this nation.
I'm going to try to touch on as many issues as I can, Mr. Attorney General. You've sued the Trump administration over 24 times. Now, each case is different, but that probably sets record for an attorney general, at least here in Pennsylvania, suing the federal government. What's your thinking when you take the Trump administration to court?
Look, if I sued Donald Trump every time I disagreed with his policies, or every time I disagreed with some statement he made, I would have sued him far more often than 24 times. I'm guided every time I make a decision to affix the good name of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to a lawsuit as to whether or not the federal government has violated the rule of law. And my record is clear, given the fact that we win when we go to court against this president. Look, the president can have his point of view, but he can't ignore the law, particularly when his actions undermine the rights of the people of Pennsylvania. I've been very careful about when I've gone to court. So let me give you an example of that. I sued the president in my early days in office over his travel ban or Muslim ban. I thought that what he did was unconscionable, but more importantly, I thought what he did was illegal. We sued and won. You know, he came back another time with an amended version, if you will, of that travel ban. I thought it was still a wrong policy. I thought it was still un-American. I actually still thought it made us less safe. But actually, I thought he crafted it in a legal manner. And I didn't sue. And ultimately, that was upheld by the Supreme Court. Similarly, when he said he was going to take money out of the Department of Defense in order to fund the border wall, I don't think that border wall was wise policy, but there was no harm to Pennsylvania as a result of no money from DOD projects that were previously appropriated to Pennsylvania were going to be diverted for this wall. And I didn't sue there. I think I may have been the only Democratic attorney general not to sue. And so it's not as though I think those policies were good and that's why I didn't sue. It's because I thought that the law was being upheld. So I look at this not from the standpoint of whether I agree or disagree with the president. I look at this from the standpoint of whether or not he's violating the law. Yeah, another example is we have here in Pennsylvania under Article 1, Section 27, Scott, you and every other Pennsylvanian has a constitutional right, a state constitutional right to clean air and pure water. How can I stand idly by when the president's violating the law at the federal level and violating our state constitutional rights by, for example, not enforcing the Clean Air Act? How can I stand by and let our constitutional rights be violated? I won't do that. And so that is why I've held this president accountable on behalf of the people of Pennsylvania whose rights are being violated. We've stood up. And when we've stood up, we've won. And so, you know, Scott, I'll end by saying this. You know, you said it's maybe an unprecedented number of times. I forget exactly how you said it at the top. You're probably
set a record, right. Yeah.
A record, yeah. You're probably right, but we also have a president who has set a record in terms of the number of times he's violated the law. This shouldn't be a partisan exercise. This shouldn't be an ideological exercise. This isn't a policy exercise. This is a legal exercise. And when the president violates the law, I'm going to hold him accountable. And the courts have consistently ruled in our favor on that.
And this is not just for you, Attorney General Shapiro, but the lawsuits that you have filed, most often you're not the only attorney general that is filing them, but they're almost always from Democrats, Democratic attorneys general, and Republicans don't file or join in those lawsuits. So at least it provides perception that it's political in nature. How do you respond to that?
Well, actually, if you look at we call this multi-state work. That's sort of the common parlance. If you look at the multi-state work that I've done, the vast majority of it has been bipartisan or nonpartisan. You all may cover, you know, the suits we file against Donald Trump more than, say, the work we do on robocalls or on opioids or on consumer protection. But more of the cases that we work on are bipartisan than ones that are, you know, limited to one party or the other. I'll give you a concrete example. I'm one of four or five attorneys general who for the last 2.5 years has been leading the national, lawsuit and settlement discussions with the opioid manufacturers and distributors to bring billions of dollars back to the states for treatment for those who are suffering from the disease of addiction, primarily because of this crisis that was manufactured by the pharmaceutical companies. We have a working group that was made up of two Democratic attorneys general, myself and the North Carolina AG, and two Republican attorneys general, Tennessee and Texas. We worked in a totally bipartisan way for the betterment of our communities. And that's what most of the work is that we do. It probably doesn't garner the same amount of media coverage, but that's the vast majority of the work we do.
You joined with 60 other attorneys general and prosecutors across the country said they wouldn't enforce a law that criminalizes abortion. The attorney general of Pennsylvania is the state, the top law enforcement officer of the state. And if I could read that language, is that represents the state and its agencies, any action brought by or against them. So how can you justify, if that were to happen, not defending a law that would criminalize abortion?
I exercise judgment and discretion every single day. And I will continue to do that as the Attorney General. And obviously the people of Pennsylvania will weigh in on how they feel about that judgment and discretion. And in my view, criminalizing a woman's right to make healthcare decisions over her own body is unjust, and it is not something that that I will participate in.
Even if the U.S. Supreme Court would uphold a law that overturned Roe versus Wade?
Well, again, you're dealing with a whole series of hypotheticals, because it's okay, Scott. If that were to happen, you're going to end up having this kickback to the states, and here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I have no doubt that no matter what the legislature would do, Governor Wolf would exercise his veto pen to ensure continued protections for women here in Pennsylvania to make decisions over their own bodies. I think that the bigger issue here is why certain men in Washington, D.C. and Harrisburg continue to think that it's okay to try and pick on women and make it harder for them to make decisions, make their own healthcare decisions, and make decisions over their own body. That's something I've been consistent about throughout my entire career and will continue to be, that a woman has the right to make that decision in conference with her doctor, loved ones, whoever else she wants to be in conference with on this. She will make those decisions.
But I guess the bigger issue is, okay, this is one issue, but when can an attorney general decide which laws he or she is going to defend, which ones they're not?
Defend is a different word, and that's a different standard.
Okay, all right, go ahead.
Okay, but you're asking me about my prosecutorial discretion. I exercise discretion every single day in whether to bring charges, how to bring charges, and the question here on the table is, am I going to arrest a woman? Am I going to arrest a doctor? I mean, you picked the hypothetical, right, Scott? But either way, those are typically the two examples that are made. Am I going to arrest a woman for making a healthcare decision over her own body? And I'm not going to do that.
Attorney General Josh Shapiro, we only have about 30 seconds left. If you could quickly leave a message for voters.
Look, I want the people of Pennsylvania to know that I'm going to continue to work my tail off on your behalf, to take on the most powerful institutions here in Pennsylvania and across the country to fight for you and to deliver results for you, to make sure that I'm on your side and acting as your lawyer, not the lawyer for the special interest. I'm incredibly proud of what we've accomplished over the last 4 years. Be honored to continue to do that work for the people of Pennsylvania.
Attorney General Josh Shapiro, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
That was the last of our candidates here on Smart Talk, but we will continue our election coverage next week. One of our segments on Monday is what poll watchers can do and what they can't do. That's coming up on Monday. Have a good weekend.